But how are you doing? How have you been?
I'm doing real good. Thank you for asking. I'm currently in America, which is why I've got the weird background. I'm actually in New York City. You can see a little bit of it from behind me. And I'm here until mid-October. I've been here since just near the end of August and having a great time, man. Having a really good time out here.
New York City is a fun, fun place. We're coming up in January to see the Phantom of the Opera on Broadway,
Awesome.
and it's one of the last showings of it, so we're pretty excited about it.
Yeah, that's real cool. Well, this is my second time being in New York, and I mean I lived in London for a while, so I'm good with the city vibe, but I like the energy of this place. It's pretty busy, pretty hectic. It can smell a bit bad if you go to the wrong places, but it's just like any city in that regard, but I like it. It's a great place, and it's just serving as a little bit of a home base right now because I've traveled out to a few different areas. I was in Florida not that long ago. I'm going to be in Arizona next week and just having some interesting conversations, speaking with a few people that are going to be coming on the record. I'm pretty excited about the potentials of what I've been able to get up to.
Well, I can't wait to see and follow you, and I'm excited for you and happy for you. That's a great development.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Now, let's get into a little bit of like the current news or the current attitude in UFOs right now, because there's been some interesting developments since the last time we spoke, with new legislation being put into the pipeline for 2023. Most of us know about that now via the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence pushing for further transparency on UFOs from the government. And just to give people who don't know about this an idea of what might be coming, this does include a sweeping review of all UFO-related data going back to, I believe, January of 1947, a sweeping review of all UFO-related non-disclosure agreements. And one of the most important things, in my opinion, is the establishing of a safety mechanism through which whistleblowers can testify without risk of prosecution. So, what do you just quickly get an idea of how you feel about these kind of things? Do you think that this could be a push within government to bring forth a more meaningful disclosure of information, or are you a little skeptical on what we might get from this? How do you feel about the upcoming changes?
Well, Jay, actually, a bit of both. I'm very pleased. I think this is great, and Congress has stepped forward and initiated long overdue changes, and I'm excited to see what happens. So I'm very pleased, and I'll tell you about some of my engagement with the DO Department of Defense later. But I am concerned. The track record of the federal government in the U.S. is not one to even just despite legislation to be one of full disclosure. So it remains to be seen, but the nature of our government is that when Congress passes law, federal agencies have to follow it, and I know that very well because I led a federal agency, as you know, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and was in the Department of the Navy. So there's a lot of good. In fact, on jumping off that, I did have an exchange with the current director now of this new All Domain Anomaly
Right,
program office,
right.
and I'm really All Domain Resolution Office, I believe
Yeah,
it's
that's the
called,
one.
and it's Sean Kirkpatrick, who is immensely qualified. If you there's a lot of times where maybe figureheads get put in places if they're not really important. This guy is really, he knows what he's doing. He's an intelligence pro. He's been involved with space intelligence activities. And I was pleasantly surprised that when I reached out to him, he responded right away. And I explained to him where my contributions might be able to the areas that I might be able to help him with. And he expressed interest. And so he said he'd get back to me. I told him I'd be willing to work as a consultant pro bono. And we'll see what he says. And this is all my area of expertise, as you know, is in all things oceans. And have a PhD in oceanography, led up the America's top ocean agency, and so I'm really interested in this whole unidentified submerged object USO aspect of these phenomena. Like I because I know where all the data sources are for studying the oceans. I know all the top leading researchers. It's just what I did, and I've not come across data on those yet, but I know where to look. And I told him, hey, in fact, I was overseeing in the US DOD. One of my commands under me was the Naval Oceanographic Office, which is the repository of all ocean data and
Right.
information for the US Navy, classified and unclassified. So that's where I want to go. And anyways, I'll stop there. And if you want to dive into anything
Well,
more, I'm happy
I
to
was
do
just
it.
going to ask if have you been approached at all to talk about this or advise in a congressional setting in terms of where to look and where to find information?
No one from the Hill has contacted me yet, but I'm putting out feelers, if you will. And that, yeah, just my area of expertise has been such, kind of the ocean science realm, that I've dealt with committees and subcommittees that do that, but there hasn't been like a crosstalk yet, I think, with those who are really interested in this, in the UAP USO phenomena, and those that are straight stick science. Actually, a great example of that. I am on the United States National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine's Ocean Studies Board. So this National Academy's Ocean Studies Board, like other boards, they pull together experts in the field, and they look at, they conduct reports and studies about all things ocean. It's pretty prestigious, and I, now that I'm on it, they kind of undertake a pretty predictable, line of research, a lot related to climate change, ocean pollution, and that's all good. I'm glad we're doing that. But these are real traditional scientists, and I do not expect them to embrace the idea of looking into USOs.
They maybe need a little bit more time and a bit more information to come out.
They do, absolutely. And you're seeing this, for example, with Professor Avi Loeb at Harvard and the Galileo
Absolutely.
Project, which I'm on, is there is a large body of mainstream astrophysicists that don't even want to touch what he's doing and openly critique it. But he has thought deeply about the universe. And to just assume we're it is really, I think, naive and myopic. And the same goes for all things in the oceans. And so I'm interested in putting out feelers with the Ocean Studies Board to see if, because ultimately the DoD, the Department of Defense, has got a charter to stand up an office and look at these data. Why not have a whole of government approach?
Well, absolutely. And I think with the type of technology available to the US inventory when it comes to kind of like sensor fusion and directing that towards the oceans, I'm sure that there's probably a lot to uncover if there was kind of a specific goal in mind to find what might have just been called uncorrelated targets to some degree beforehand or just spoofs on the radar and actually drilling down to find out what's going on. Do you think that it's more pervasive in the oceans or in the atmosphere or in space? Do you have any inclination towards what might be kind of more common?
I could tell you this. I can't tell you what's more common, but to me, we know we have anecdotes and even observations from the Navy pilots that these interfaces, the air-sea interface, is not really an issue to these craft. Obviously, they
Right.
defy the laws of physics as we know them, so water or air doesn't seem to make a difference. And so the point, though, is that for us to detect using our conventional means, whether it be satellites, underwater sensors like sonars, the ocean's just much harder to observe things, and that's why we know so little about it. We have observed, we've mapped the surface of Mars and the Moon to a higher resolution than the ocean floor across the world. I mean, we've only mapped globally to modern standards about 20% of the world's oceans. In the U.S.
It's
alone, we have only
incredible.
mapped about 40% of the exclusive economic zone. And so there's just so much.
Yeah.
When I was with NOAA, we were discovering new ocean species every year,
Wow.
usually about a dozen to two dozen. I mean,
Wow.
in fact, get this, Jay, we actually found a new species of killer whale in Antarctica a few years ago, our scientists down there. And just think about that. It's like, you think, okay, the new species we're finding, maybe it's like a microbe or some small little piece of plankton. We're talking about megafauna is what the term is, and that we still don't even know all that there is. So the oceans are really, I think, I like to say they are our next frontier, because they're right here and we know so little about it, so that we're always making discoveries. It's exciting, and I think this need, this UAP USO needs to be added in on our plate to our plate of exploration objectives. When I agreed to come on your show today, I wanted to share some things with you that I thought were just fascinating. One is, there is an American explorer named Victor Vescovo, and he started out as a commander in the U.S. Navy intelligence community. He was a reserve officer, and his day job was a private equity investor. He got quite wealthy, and then he started to basically push the boundaries of exploration. He finished the Explorers Club Grand Slam, which is hiking or climbing all the seven peaks in the continents, including Everest, and skiing to the North Pole and the South Pole.
Wow.
And he, great guy, by the way. I really admire him. And but then he came up with the idea, because no one had ever done it, that diving in a submersible to the deepest trenches in all the world's oceans. No one's done it, and we've only gone to the deepest part of the ocean before him twice, the Challenger Deep and the Marianas Trench, and so he got with a great engineering outfit in Florida called Triton Submersibles. They built him a full ocean depth sub, and it's called the Limiting Factor. And in 2019 to 2020, he went and dove all the five deepest trenches around the world: Puerto
Wow.
Rico Trench, and the Challenger Deep, etc. Great book on it called, I don't have it here, but it's called, oh gosh, what is it? It's by Josh Young, and it's called something like Expedition Deep Ocean. Long story short, he's still doing these dives, and and when he was doing a checkout, and I partnered with him. When I was at NOAA, I signed a memorandum of agreement so we could get some of his data. We put our scientists on a ship. We knew that he had something that was exquisite and a national asset, and we wanted to leverage it, and he was willing to do it because he's a great individual. And so, he was doing a checkout of his boat and system off Southern California at a time. And I stay in touch with him, and I wrote him, and I said, where the Nimitz incident occurred that we all know about. And I told him, I said, "Hey, Victor, I'm part of this Galileo project, and my colleagues and I know about this Navy incident. And we were curious if we want to map the area. We want to get some new maps of the area to basically see if there's evidence of any interaction with the seafloor of these kind of USOs or even underwater infrastructure." And I threw it out there as just sort of what the title of my email to him was: an ocean expedition like no other, because I wasn't sure if he'd take me seriously, to be honest with you. And he basically just said, "I'll take a look." And he did. He went, and I got the data right here. It's under my microphone, by the way, the seed, the disc. And I'm gonna take it. And he went and mapped this area. There's some interesting features, but I need to get a better processing system to look at them more closely. So I actually have a member of the Ocean Studies Board, Dr. Larry Mayer at University of New Hampshire, a world expert on bathymetry, who's agreed to take a look at it for me. And so you have credible people that aren't being gun shy about it. And I'm hoping to really, kind of up that level of interest as I get out and about.
Well, I think this is just going to happen.
Hey,
It will
Jay.
have. Yeah. Can
Oh,
you hear
go
me?
ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, we're good. Yeah. Sorry. I had another microphone issue. I was listening and trying to connect it back. But I think that this is happening more widely across the board in science as we approach getting more answers on this type of phenomenon, because it's, as you said before, it's a profound challenge to people who have kind of been immersed in a different type of model for what could be in reality. And these are providing pretty significant challenges to the models of physics and also just the concept of life in the universe and our hierarchy within evolution. But we're seeing this engagement. The Galileo Project is a prime example. And I think that even if we don't get everything that we want to get from government, I feel that there's been enough of a push and there is still enough momentum. And there's certainly a lot of chatter within Congress. And it's a brilliant bipartisan talking point. It's extending across, the left and right aisle. People are pretty much united on the idea of getting more information on this. So I think that we're approaching a time where even if the government doesn't satisfy every researcher out there with the treasure trove of knowledge that a lot of us believe they have, I think we're making significant steps in the surface world, in kind of standard scientific communities towards this becoming acceptable. And I don't really see that slowing down, regardless of whether the government goes in the direction we want it to go.
I think you're right. I see that. Like, you probably know Gary Nolan, or
Yeah,
maybe
yeah.
you have you has he been on your show?
He hasn't been on my show. I'm trying to get him to do that. He's actually going to be at a conference in Manhattan on the 8th of October, which I'm going to. So I'm going to sit down and shake the man's hand, and hopefully we can get him on at some point.
Good, good. I wish you luck. He
Thank you.
he's a great example of just a a very credible scientist who is willing to take a look, like Victor did with my data. He decided to take a look, and look what he's found. And I think you're right. I think the government's going to help, but ultimately the community, the scientific community, has made a big change. And I think that I would predict that this century we will see a sea change. And you know, I was thinking about this the other day. Have you ever had Don Hoffman on your show?
No, but I'm aware of him.
He's great, and he's you know, quickly for the listeners, he has a great TED talk called, oh gosh, I forgot what it's called, but it's a Don Hoffman TED talk, and you'll find it. And he talks about the fact that space-time is doomed, and what he means by that is that our materialistic view of the physical universe, that it is where everything's kind of, you know, four-dimensional, if you will, is that doesn't really account for consciousness, he believes is going to be transformed very soon. And because all these complex physical interactions can be explained when you consider consciousness. And it's just like, you know, with quantum theory, where the measurement or an observer affects an outcome.
Yes.
That's what he's talking about. And ultimately, what I'm like, the way I wanted to sort of get at it is that this, in 1905, or when Einstein published his papers on relativity, and that transformed science as we know it. And just a few years before, Albert Michelson, a Nobel Prize winner in the United States, he worked actually at my old command, the U.S. Naval Observatory, for a time. And he won the Nobel Prize, I think, for precisely measuring the speed of light. And he made the statement before Einstein's papers that we know all there is, you know, in terms of physical laws, and now it's just a matter of, you know, measuring them more precisely. And then all of a sudden Einstein comes up with the relativity and the fact that the speed of light's constant, and it's really that things are different whatever depending on how fast you're accelerating. And everything changed, you know. And I think we're on the cusp of such a change. And I think Don Hoffman is keyed into this, that when we account for consciousness, and he's got mathematical a basis for a lot of this in terms of probability. And so and that's what I think is powerful. So I'm excited to follow him and others. And I think we're going to, I'm optimistic in our lifetimes, we're going to see that kind of Einstein relativity change in terms of a discovery that's going to explain a lot of what we're seeing now.
For those interested, the TED talk is called "Do We See Reality as It Is?" And it's Donald Hoffman. So you should definitely check that out. And I
He's good.
completely agree with this point of view. And in fact, you know, this is something that I've been talking about a little bit more recently, and just kind of mulling over my own ideas around, like you said, the observer effect with the photon changing from a particle form into a wave form, and then vice versa. And I put this idea out, I'll float it by you. Maybe you'll have some thoughts about it. So if a photon particle is a wave of energy until a measurement is made, which causes it to collapse down into a particle state, what if we look to ourselves as a photon particle, and this whole reality that feels so solid to us is basically us measuring and continuously measuring? So it's in a constant state of collapse. Everything's in a constant state of being dense and physical because we're consistently observing and measuring it. But then when we go to sleep, or when we have transcendental meditative experiences, or we have near-death experiences, or we have psychedelic experiences, anything that turns off the default measuring network of the human being and its immediate environment, suddenly we're in a very strange space, a non-local space where, you know, things can be created instantly, language takes on new meanings, even encounters with other intelligences apparently seem to be possible through certain perturbings of human consciousness. And it makes me wonder if you could almost look at our normal linear life of measuring our environment as us collapsing everything down into this particle form. And then when we turn that off through various methods, you then are in almost like a wave function style of consciousness where it's gone from localized to non-local. What do you think about that?
This is interesting, Jay. I've thought a lot about this, and ultimately, I think that explanation that you've just laid out is a possible explanation of what happens when we die.
Right,
And
right.
I've told you, and on the previous show, I may have mentioned that my daughter
Yes.
is sensitive, and we know that entities exist after death. I'm just going to tell you that. I know this. I know people who can tap into those energies. You know, it's interesting. Since I saw you last, I believe, and I know some will have opinions of this, but there's one of these medium sensitives is named Teresa Caputo. She's near you right now, actually. She's
Oh,
from Long
really?
Island.
Oh,
She's the
okay.
one. She's the one that was in this show, Long Island Medium. And now, granted, TV shows sometimes are fabricated, and you could make that claim just watching her show. But I went to one of her appearances in Baltimore just a few weeks ago, months ago, I don't know. And it was stunning how much she tapped into people. So there was an instant, and there was a moment in her show where she got went to the middle of the audience on the front, and she found three people that all had relatives that passed from like a drowning in the Chesapeake Bay where I live. This was in Baltimore. I mean, this was a highly local, very specific thing. One guy was a waterman who was an oyster farmer, and I forgot what happened to the other two. But like she just started pulling out these things, and they're all like, "Yes, this is what happened." And this is like you can't make this stuff up. You can't even like pretend to try to make that happen. These people were all legitimate. You could hear, you know, the Maryland accent in their voices. They were
Right.
so local, you know,
And
and.
there wasn't like suggestive language from her, like prompts, things that kind of spark memories. And
Well, you know, of course, you could accuse her of that, but
well,
it
I
was.
have to, you always have to be conscious of the people typing away on their keyboards already going, this isn't true, this isn't real. And I truly believe people have this natural talent. So I'm not a skeptic, but I would say I'm skeptical of people that make a career out of it, but there's also nothing wrong with making a career out of an innate natural talent. So it's a very fine line to draw. And so if you feel confident that this person wasn't leading people down that kind of road, then that's
I'm very confident, and I think you can really pick out people who fake. But and she just kind of fires. There's no pauses. She's just it's all there. And ultimately, though, you know, so those are what I've observed, and others. And so I think when you're getting it, like, so what explains that, Jay? What explains her ability to see the unseen? And I think that unseen energy that we all have alive, but maybe when we pass. Is can be explained possibly by this wave function, you know, consciousness, because we're energy. And I think this is very interesting. You know, what Einstein, energy equals mass times the speed of light squared. Energy and mass are equivalent. Well, right now, here we are, four-dimensional reality, mass, we're all realized maybe through this consciousness and then making that energy collapse to matter. But we're energy, right? And so, and I don't understand the process of all that, but I think you're onto something. And I mean, I've thought a lot about this for a decade. Like, what explains these things, and us? And I think we have a lot of smart people that are looking into this too. And I'm hopeful we are going to be able to characterize that much like Einstein did, and then Newton before him with Newtonian physics. That ne this next generation of physics, I think, is going to be exciting. I'm anxious to see it work out.
Yeah, you and me both, brother. I really do feel that we're on like you said, that tipping point, right at the end of a outdated model and a paradigm shift coming in. And it's funny because Professor Avi Loeb was recently he was on that brilliant podcast, Theory of Everything, and during this he was asked about his thoughts on CE5. And I was interested in this because, well, and for those that don't know, that's a method or a set of methodologies for initiating contact with some aspect of this phenomena through the utilization of kind of states of mind, usually meditative states of mind, through which intention and coherent thought can be kind of projected and act as some form of a signal that's recognized and responded to by what is right now, at least to me, a currently unknown phenomena. And Avi said he was open to understanding this, open to testing these ideas if proven to be true. These realizations, he said, would place the standard models of physics under immense pressure. Now, as someone who's had repeated success with such methods, I know on a subjective level, I've got no evidence, no video proof of it, only my word, but it did happen. And so for me, on a subjective level, it's real, which means the standard models will need to be changed in physics. It's just kind of a matter of when, I guess, physics catches up to intuition and realizes that this is a part of the mechanics of our reality. And, you know, I'd like to know what you think about these types of methods for contact, because you do have that open mind when it comes to what consciousness could be. And, you know, in essence, understanding that an expanded state of human consciousness that's orientated towards an intention or an invitation for contact to occur, the fact that that actually happens is quite an extraordinary discovery, if we could objectively prove it and satisfy the scientific community that it's actually repeatable. So what do you think about these methods and what they suggest, I guess, both in relation to the nature of consciousness itself and also in relation to the nature of the phenomenon itself, because it does seem to interact some aspect of it through these types of methods?
Well, Jay, I'm not very familiar with these methods, but in this whole subject of consciousness and intent, and that, and I understand what you're getting at here. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do think, if we go back to the slit experiment, I think ultimately, if you look at that, and also you look at the nature of quantum entanglement, I guess traditional physics have a hard time with it. Even Einstein had a hard time with that.
Of course, yeah. Spooky action at a distance, yeah.
Love it. But that's just being able to describe the unseen that's what we're talking about here. And then we already have faced this problem. You know, electromagnetic energy does a lot, you know, and look at it, it's our whole basis of communications and a whole range of other things we do, you and me talking together. And we can't see that.
Yeah.
So I think you're getting at, this is just another level of that, mm-hmm. about phenomena that occur that are influence outcomes and on decisions and then that we just can't see. And I think we have to open our mind to that aspect. It's mm-hmm. not, we can't see everything. And we already know this. Everybody relies on it every day, these kind of phenomena, or phenomena that can't be seen. And we just need to, you know, take that to another level. And I think what you're getting at, but maybe you could just expound a little bit more on, because I've read about that. I heard that on your podcast once and I just didn't capture it all.
Yeah. Well, people who've been in the research community for a while will know the term CE5. So if you haven't heard of that before, it stands for Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind. And it was,
I'm with you now. Forgive me. I didn't know you used that term.
Oh, okay. Right. Yeah. 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 Well, it's a term coined by Dr. Stephen Greer, and he's a very polarizing figure, but I've always made a point of saying that's just one man's attempt at doing this. And it's, you know, there's a whole litany of ways in which you can maybe make this happen. So, you know, because he can be a bit of a controversial figure and divides people within the community, but I understand that, but it's not necessarily about Stephen Greer. It's just the idea that the human brain body interface with, like you said, this electromagnetic energy that's going around it. As we know, we produce this, you know, very strong electromagnetic field through our heart and through our brain. It's the idea that as a little bubble encased in electromagnetism, floating in an ocean of electromagnetism, you can send coherent signals through this network, this medium of energy that's connecting all of space and time. And that perhaps there are more sophisticated intelligences than ourselves that have developed methods of refining consciousness, maybe through technology or maybe just through whatever natural methods they may have come across, are able to respond to this, are able to actually kind of flash up and say, yep, we can hear you. We can hear this signal that you're sending to us. And as wild as that sounds, I did a, you might be interested in it. I did a kind of talk for about 40, 50 minutes on my channel quite recently, where I tried my best to just kind of articulate in quasi-science talk, because I'm not a scientist, just trying my best to articulate these things to break down why I think this works, why I think that type of contact works. And it's not a necessarily unknown thing within the UFO community. And there's a pretty significant section of people that dedicate their time to going out into fields at night and doing this kind of thing. And there's actually quite a few pretty compelling night vision recordings of stuff that I personally have seen with my own eyes. So when I see the video, I go, okay, well, that looks like what I saw.
I have seen some shows and pieces on this, and I think there's no reason that can't be valid, because just consider this. So first off, we agree that some people are more open and sensitive to a range of being aware of other entities, and they, like my friend who can tap into your own history and being, and my daughter who has seen entities, and so acknowledging that, then why and then just take it to another level. So Avi Loeb is a great, Avi Loeb at Harvard. He's prolific. He writes every day almost in Medium and the publication Medium. But he's often writing about the fact that the universe is very old, it's very large, and just the probabilities are such that there are likely other intelligences in the universe, or have been. They may be extinct now, but we're looking for artifacts of them. And ultimately, you have to consider, especially us, our human species is just so I'd say infantile in terms of its existence on the Earth. And so just think about us evolving in another 50,000 years or a million. What is our consciousness going to be like then? If because I would say that we're the capabilities that I described, you don't quite see that as high functioning in the animal kingdom, right? So we've evolved, I think, in a way that not every species has. Now, we don't really know. Maybe some species do have the ability to communicate in ways that way. But ultimately, I think we're pretty well evolved. And that might mean in the future, who knows what kind of capability we'll have in terms of ability to connect to others and call and draw on other intelligences like you're suggesting. To me, that's just totally in the range of the possible. If you can accept now what I've seen and I through my daughter and others like Teresa, and people like her.
Yeah, maybe this is where artificial intelligence becomes a more prominent player in the role of decoding those mysteries. Is there maybe a symbiosis between quantum computational abilities, artificial intelligence, and in some way the human spirit in order for us to articulate and understand the wider implications of the universe? Because we are certainly moving towards some form of coupling between man and machine. I mean, it's already happened with our reliance upon technology. I mean, me and you are now relying upon technology just to have this conversation. So there certainly seems to be, as each year passes, a steady progression towards jumping into a new landscape of experience, the digital landscape, the virtual ocean of information. And I just wonder if maybe this is a characteristic of the next stage in human evolution. What do you think about AI and the implications of where we're going with technology? Is this a natural thing that we're doing, or are we making an error in judgment?
Well, it's happening, I can tell you that. And did I talk to you in my last interview with you about this book called Sapiens?
The name sounds familiar, so you might have, but go on, remind me and the audience.
Yeah, this is by an Israeli author named Yuval Harari, and he's brilliant. He's an absolute polymath, and he wrote a book, just really a very objective treatment of us as species, compared to other species in this on the planet, and it's kind of sobering. But then that was all about us, and his follow-on book is called, so like Homo sapiens, the first book Sapiens. His second book is called Homo Deus. And it's about the future, and he looks at like, and it's exactly what you said, the combination of technology and our evolution and the fusion of biotechnology. His premise is it's going to make us godlike. That's the title, Homo Deus. And he just talks about us extending our life to centuries, and then how will that affect our intelligence as we evolve. And just the capabilities and it, there's there that we will possess that are hard even to predict. I think my grandmother lived to be 100. She was born before the Wright brothers launched the first flight,
Wow.
and she passed away where the space shuttle was making multiple missions to space.
Wow.
So what are we going to see in our lifetime? And with that, and it's a great book, the Homo Deus. It's just fascinating.
Yeah, you definitely did bring that up last time. I remember the author's name, and I think I actually have a copy of the first book somewhere and haven't read it yet, so I'll dig it out and have a look. I agree. I think that it's a very exciting time. It's a very disruptive time. It doesn't take much convincing for people to look at the world and go, oh my God, there's real problems everywhere. But I tend to try and look at that more as a developmental path, and there's going to be evolutionary stresses and strains. I mean, you look at your own life and how ups and downs are just a part of the basic journey of a human being. I think that that's probably the same on the macro scale. If you just look at the human race itself as one single being, I think we're just going through some evolutionary creases and they're being ironed out. And in order for them to be ironed out, there's got to be the dissolution of systems that are inadequate and the models that are inadequate, and it's going to present profound challenges. But ultimately, in the long run, it informs and it gives you wisdom and it gives you more insight. And I think that we are in a very interesting period where, not too far into the future, insight is going to be given.
You know, I'm reminded of a book I read a while ago, and I bet some of your listeners have read it, by an author named Michael Talbot, and the book is called The Holographic Universe. And it, have you read it?
I haven't read it. I'm terrible, but I have heard of it.
It's a fascinating treatment of this sort of combination of physics and spirituality, if you mm-hmm. will. And there's a, it's very interesting. Some of the not claims, some of his examples or anecdotes are pretty out there. I mean, I haven't had a hard time with them, and I try to be open, but it's fascinating. And what I found fascinating is just his explanation of the universe in this holographic construct, which might also be another way to explain it. And like the way you talk about collapsing the wave function or consciousness causing that, there's a very similar explanation when you think about the universe. If it's a hologram, like shining light or energy onto it to create a four dimensional image. And so that just kind of came to mind to me. I'd be interested. I've read that book twice. It was so interesting to me. I probably need to look at it a third time to really understand it.
Well, I trust your recommendation. So I make sure I get that one either on audiobook. I tend to listen to audiobooks these days. I feel bad about that. I need to train myself back into reading. I used to love reading, like turning the pages, and it is good for your brain, but I just find it easier now to have an audiobook on, do other things and listen to it. But either way, I'm going to get that information into my head. I agree. And it's funny because I feel like these are just the dividing lines between an esoteric perspective and a scientific perspective. You know, the physicists will say, we're in a hologram, we might be inside a computer. And the esoteric people will say, oh, it's the conscious mind of God or the conscious mind of the universe. It's like, okay, well, which one of these is correct? Maybe neither of them are correct, but something is certainly going on that I feel transcends just this dense physical state that we're currently in. I think there is something profound about life that does transcend the material. And I believe you are pretty confident in that as well.
Yeah. And interestingly, like one maybe just topic to explore that mm-hmm. might relate to that. I have no idea, but so as we, let's go back to UAP and you know, especially when I look at like Ryan Graves, has he been on your show?
Not yet, but one of the people I'm talking to.
Correct. You know, just this is U.S. Navy pilot, lieutenant, and he, you know, I loved him coming forward. He was involved with one of the Navy incidents and had seen visually some of these UAPs, and I love it because, you know, I was in the Navy, and I just the guy is so authentic. Mm-hmm. You know, I know UFO and it has all these comments on various individuals, and I don't even know what they are about Ryan, but I suspect that he has doubters. I'll tell you, I was in the Navy. I know these guys. This guy cannot be more legitimate, and I really applaud him because he really stepped out of the box, and I'm proud of him. I want to meet him. You know, him and others, there's so many different variants of these observations, like the cube in a sphere object, right, or the Tic Tac, or the, what's that rotating one called, the gimbal. Mm-hmm. You know, that's like, when I look at the diversity, there's triangle observations all out there, you know, why? Like, what is the unity in all this? And I don't know. My only kind of, I guess, one possibility might be that, like you said, when whatever these beings, entities are doing, they're interacting with observers. And maybe it is the nature of the observers, who are all different in different situations, that's somehow generating the different manifestation.
Right.
That's the only unity I could possibly think in all of them. Otherwise, it just seems weird. Yeah. Or they're all from all over the universe, and everybody just evolved differently, and they became experts at different engineering principles. I don't know. I'm just dying to find out, though.
Yeah, I think these are the questions that we now need to answer. It's not about whether or not they exist. It's right, what are they? Can we categorize them? Are they separate? Is it just representations of the same thing? I don't know if Jacques Vallée still entertains that idea, but I know that he certainly at one point felt very strongly that the kind of the framework from Carl Jung was one of the more kind of accurate frameworks for looking at this, that it could be a single consciousness projecting in many forms. These are the questions we have. You know, why do perhaps, as you said, the military mindset might see a triangle craft with lights across it, and the more spiritual, peaceful mindset might see orbs of angelic light, or maybe there's literally no correlation between the two. These are the unknowns for us now. It's not whether or not they exist, it's just whether or not we can actually understand the nature of their existence in the first place. And I'm excited to see where it goes. I'm interested in the USOs because we have these platforms that, as you described before, they're transmedium. They can operate flawlessly in multiple environments, air, sea, and space. Do you think, and this is just speculating, just having a little bit of fun with it, but do you think that these craft are coming in from space into the air and then into the oceans? Or even more radically, in my opinion, could these possibly be in reverse? Are they coming from our oceans, can operate in our atmosphere and within the vacuum of space? What is more shocking, an extraterrestrial presence or a terrestrial presence that's been so far avoiding direct contact and has somehow developed technologies whilst operating in an environment that, at least to us, makes no sense? Like, how could advanced civilizations grow and mature within an oceanic environment? So, what are your thoughts on the ultimate origin of these platforms and their operators?
Oh, I have no way of knowing. And I think anything's on the table. It could be both. It really could be both. Why not? I mean, if we're already going out there to say these are doing things we just cannot explain, then everything's possible, right? Anything's possible. It just can't be explained. So it could, and I mean, both possibilities are transformational in terms of our understanding. That was the title of the article I wrote with Avi. Will we soon rewrite the textbooks on our place in the universe? Was in the periodical called The Hill, and that's what we're doing. We're talking about that right now, and it's just exciting either way. So I want to know, and that's why I'm looking into some ocean data, as I told you, and had Victor Vescovo to do the survey for me, unbelievably, and let's find out is all I got to say.
Yeah. How are you finding your time in the Galileo project? Are you enjoying it?
Yeah, I am, because I really the very 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 competent engineers and scientists on the team. Avi's very shrewd too. He doesn't allow fakers on the team.
Right.
He picks good high quality members. Everyone's committed. We had an in-person meeting in August. It was a delight to meet everybody. And Avi's a really terrific leader. He really knows how to build a team and keep a drumbeat, as we'd call it in the military, by reinforcing issues and having periodic meetings and keeping the momentum of progress. He's terrific. In fact, I'll share with the listeners, this is like one of the most important kind of water ocean related developments. So you might have read that he discovered with his post no no his undergraduate researcher Amir Siraj, a meteor that landed or hit the Earth in 2011, and it was the first known interstellar meteor to be observed. And he had to go back through a bunch of records, basically, and data to determine, oh, this is the very first meteor of interstellar origin. There was another one, I think, observed later, and then there was this the Oumuamua that he observed, which also was of interstellar origin, but that never landed. That just kind of zorched out of the solar system. And so we have this one meteor that landed off Papua New Guinea. It didn't land. It burned up in the atmosphere, and its debris fell into the through the atmosphere onto the seafloor off Papua New Guinea. And so he has just gotten someone to fund an expedition to go off Papua New Guinea, and I helped him. I'm helping him coordinate this expedition because I've been involved with a lot of ocean expeditions, and we even published or we're publishing a paper on it where we're going to go find the fragments of that meteor. And what's really interesting,
Okay.
Jay, is this has been done before. And when I was working with NOAA in the U.S., the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, we funded an expedition, and it was with the ship of the famous ocean explorer who discovered the Titanic, Bob Ballard. His ship went off the west coast of the US, the Olympic coast off Washington, and they searched for and found the debris of a similar meteorite that was not of interstellar origin. And they found it, and they were able to kind of characterize some aspects of that meteorite. Now, all those little all the fragments were just basically, burned up iron that had a kind of had it sunk to the seafloor, and they had to use a magnet to pick it up. And we're going to go use the same kind of approach off Papua New Guinea. And of course, Avi's interested because there's some interesting the observations about that he was able to determine was one, this meteorite was going faster than any that had ever been observed before, like 44 kilometers per second or something
Wow.
crazy.
Wow.
And then one, that was one anomaly. Two, it when in looking how it burned up through the atmosphere, they determined that it was harder than any other meteorite observed. So harder than iron. And I can just hear Avi talking about it because he's been interviewed so often about it. What is harder than iron? Like, what could it be? Is it an alloy? And if that's the case, are we not going to just pick up little sand-like grains? Are we actually going to find equipment? And I love it. He uses that word. I want to find equipment. And like he talks about, in the same way that if a caveman, for example, discovered an iPhone and he wouldn't know what it was. But then all of a sudden, if he pressed a button, something would happen. And he would then probably conclude that maybe it wasn't just a rock. And so he's like, I want to find something and I want to push that button.
Okay, so he, I
So.
mean, he has at least some level of speculation towards maybe this is something more than just simply a meteorite.
Well, yeah, based on the observations of it being faster and harder and known
Right.
interstellar origin, he just knows it's different.
Yep.
And he's
Worth
very
checking
good
out.
about, he's happy to speculate and kind of have those discussions, but he makes no conclusions
Yeah.
until he
Yeah.
gets the data. And so we're gonna retrieve these fragments and we are gonna study them, and then we'll have some data, and then we can start making conclusions or at least hypotheses. And I think it's a exciting one to help him with. I'm really pleased to be doing it. And so the watch out for more on this. We're calling the expedition Cosmic Recovery.
Oh, cool. Are you going to be like filming at all? You're going to be presenting it in some sort of
Actually, Netflix is going to send a team to document it.
Oh,
I
brilliant.
may be, yeah. There, I may be on board. I'm not sure if I can break away that long. And it's going to be a limited number of people on board the ship because of the room. And to be honest with you, there's just a. I probably am the least valuable person in this group because
Well, I
I
mean,
just haven't been on a.
Oceanic administrator is pretty good on the oceans, I imagine.
Well, what I mean is I ran the agency, but I haven't been on board an ocean expedition since 2006. I mean, I've been deep sea fishing and I've been scuba diving, but there are some experts that we need to have on board to be able to use the develop the tools, operate them, and then actually when we get stuff, analyze it and go, yep, that's a meteorite. So there's a we want they're the priority, those folks and those engineers, and I'm kind of shoreside support is what they call it.
What do you think is going to kind of come from these talks within Congress in terms of the establishing of a safety mechanism for whistleblowers? Because this interests me. I'm sure you know about the Admiral Wilson leaks, that you're familiar with the Admiral Wilson leaks, and that now they're being discussed in a congressional setting. And I found it very interesting that Dr. Gary Nolan decided on his interview with Tucker Carlson to acknowledge not only does he believe that the notes are real, and he did so as well on my friend Ross Coulthart's documentary, that the notes are real and that it's a real event. But he also briefed Mike Gallagher on the notes prior to him going into that discussion with the two Pentagon officials. Do you think that, do you think, have you looked into those? Do you feel like they're real? Have you read the notes?
I've not looked into him, Jay, but I really don't. I don't believe. I have no reason to doubt, to be honest with you. And in fact, this has been the sort or the culture of the government for so long had been one of suppressing d disclosure. It's just the nature of things. And I mean, gosh, there are much less sensitive issues that you kind of have a choke on. When I work with with NOAA, I had a there's just a tendency to watch any given White House briefing. It doesn't matter what administration. Okay. I actually, what happened with the Trump administration is happening with the Biden administration, and that every administration puts, they have their priorities, they have their talking points for any given issue, and they stick to it. And when and they judiciously look at every other agencies under them, under the White House, so federal agencies like NASA, like the Department of Defense. And if you go off script, your future is very short. That happens, and you'll see every agency, and so like what's it, this current administration is really keen on climate. Well, I'm not judging either way. I'm just saying that's it. And so every administration talks about climate and climate this and their priorities and climate that. And you see it, they all just toe the line. And so and if you don't toe that line, you have a very, again, you have a very short future. Because that's just the priorities of the administration. That's the way the government has always worked. And in federal career political appointees know this because they get there for that reason. And career officials know they stay there for that reason to be able to follow the administration's priorities. So long answer there, Jay. I'm glad to finally see that people are now going to be protected and free to say what they've seen. Because those security restrictions, kind of people just that stick with them once they leave government. They don't want to step outside the box. They know they try to still toe the line, and there's a sort of fear there. And but hey, Jay, it's great to see you again. My time is short,
No
but I want
worries.
to thank you, and I want to thank your listeners for being interested in this. And I hope you have a great time in New York.
Thank you.
And I'm looking forward to connecting with you in person at some point down the road.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure to have you on, Tim. Just give me one sec. I want to say something before you go, but it's always great to have you on.